Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Elizabeth Kerr from Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. It's Infrastructure Week here in Washington, which means that hundreds of business and community leaders and policymakers from across the country are in town advocating for investment in roads and bridges, our energy grid, internet access, airports, and a range of other priorities. And so we're happy to bring this discussion to you today with Representative Elizabeth Estey from Connecticut. She's the Vice-Ranking Member of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure and the co-chair of the New Democrat Coalition's 21st Century Infrastructure Task Force. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders from across America. And at these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their business and how Washington can work better with businesses to accelerate the economy. To date, more than 550 senior administration officials, members of Congress, governors, and mayors have participated in our programming, and that's all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I need to cover a couple housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record and there may be reporters on the line, but that means we are recording this call, which is great because we can send you a podcast of this call in a follow-up email, and everybody who registered for this call will receive that. Finally, there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice with the Congresswoman. You can do this in one of two ways. You can press 1 at any time to ask your question live, or you can email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and I'll read that aloud for you. So one more time, if you'd like to ask a question live, press 1 on your telephone keypad at any time, and you'll be entered into the queue, or you can email that question to us at info@businessfwd.org. Now, when you email us or when you introduce yourself on the call, please introduce yourself with your name and your business and where you're calling from. With that, let's get started. Please welcome Representative Elizabeth Estey.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you to Center Forward, and most of all, thank you to all the folks who are joining in on this call. It's much cooler inside than outside right now in Washington, but I am delighted to be with you and have a chance to talk about the need and the opportunity that we have around rebuilding and reformulating America's infrastructure. And it's particularly appropriate as this is National Infrastructure Week. So I thought what I would do is spend a few minutes outlining sort of what the need is. Most of you are probably familiar with that. A bit about what the proposals are that are out there, both in Congress and to the extent we can divine them out of the administration. And then pretty quickly move to your questions, because I really want to be as helpful as I can in untangling what's actually happening behind the curtain of the legislative process in these rather unusual times we're in. So again, I am the Vice-Ranking Member of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and the co-chair of the New Democrat Coalition Infrastructure sort of working group. I've been on the committee now for 4.5 years. Daughter and granddaughter of civil engineers, so I grew up in a household where I really knew about building big things in America, dams and bridges and major public works. So I have a long-time interest in and commitment to this. America right now is receiving a D-plus grade in infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers recently scored infrastructure just last month. We are still at a D-plus. That is not something any parent in America would be excited if their child came home with a D-plus rating. That's the same rating that we had 4 years ago, slightly up from the D from 2009, but frankly, unacceptably low. Ensuring the safe and efficient movement of goods and people is one of the absolutely core functions of federal government. But for too long, we failed to meet those needs of the American people. Sometimes I think of it as if it's America's house has a roof that's leaking. Now, all of us know it is not exciting to replace the roof on your house, but it is a disaster if you allow that to collapse. And that's frankly where we've gotten to as a country. Our roads are congested. In 2014, congestion was estimated to cost American commuters $160 billion in lost productivity and fuel. And in urban areas, the estimate is that urban commuters spend 42 hours a year in, parked on over-congested roads. That's an entire work week. So if you think about the productivity, and if you think about the frustration factor for Americans who never have enough money and never have enough time, it is incredibly aggravating to American families. Too many of our roads are no longer safely designed for the traffic that they're being forced to bear. In many of our communities, we now have pedestrians and bicyclists who are using the roads. And in our major arteries, the ones I know best up and down the eastern seaboard, the designs are not designed for the speed and the size of the vehicles that we're using right now, and that in and of itself poses problems and, in fact, contributes to the 35,000 people a year who die in traffic fatalities. They're often in terrible condition. I get stopped every time I am home. I get stopped by people who are frustrated with or angry about the potholes and the damage it's doing to their vehicles. A woman last week stopped me in Waterbury, Connecticut, where we were looking at one of the largest and most aging bad infrastructure projects for highways in the country, the infamous Mixmaster of Waterbury, Connecticut. And she came just to tell me that she was sitting with a huge bill for damage to her car from an enormous pothole. And she said, that's the reality of what it means for her. And that's true for every single member of Congress. 39% of American bridges are viewed as structurally deficient. They are designed to have a lifespan of 50 years. Many of them are past lifespan already at this point. And this is an economic cost. It's an estimate of $3,400 per year per household because of poor infrastructure. We could be gaining enormous number of people working in jobs if we were to repair the infrastructure, and as or more importantly, people would get to work on time and get home on time and safely. And that is of enormous value to all Americans. So there are costs we're incurring right now, but there are advantages we would be gaining both in terms of time and jobs and productivity in the economy if we meet this. In addition to our roads, which are the most obvious for many Americans, our rail system needs to be expanded and upgraded. That's both passenger rail and freight in our public transit systems. Estimates are $148 billion needed for rail expansion over the coming years. We have congestion at our airports. This figure is astounding, but to those on this call, I'm sure not surprising to you, 24 of the top 30 U.S. airports may soon experience the, quote, Thanksgiving peak traffic volume once a week. That used to be a once-a-year phenomenon. And the 2 million passengers who are traveling through our airspace, every week need something better than what we've got right now. There are enormous clean water, stormwater, clean water, and wastewater needs in this country. As we saw with Flint, Michigan, there are appalling and tragic costs when we don't keep up with that. We have levees that are not even cataloged at this point, dams that also need billions of their own investment. So that's the nature of the challenge that we face. We need to replace America's roof right now. Now, what do we think may happen right now? I'm going to outline a little bit of what we know. First from the White House. During his campaign, President Trump said he would fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, and hospitals. And he said he was committed to doing that and it would put millions of our people to work as we rebuild. The beginning of this week, Transportation Secretary Chao spoke at an Infrastructure Week event and told people who were attending that event that they should expect a proposal in, quote, the next several weeks. I can say we have not received anything yet and are waiting for that. Neither I nor any of my colleagues, as far as I know, have seen any specifics of the plan, but Secretary Chao told the audience there that there would be $200 billion in direct federal funding to leverage a total of approximately $1 trillion in spending from public and private sectors. I and many of my colleagues have strong reservations about that, as well as the earlier proposal authored by Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross. The Ross-Navarro plan, which is the only specific that we have been able to look at to this point, which came out prior to the election, would essentially create tax credits to repay equity investors more than 80% of their entire investment up front. And that's just not going to fly with many people in Congress. And beyond that point, public-private partnerships, so-called P3s, do have an important role that they can play. But even countries that do have extensive experience in P3s, like Canada, the amount of what traditionally we call public works or public infrastructure, it's only about 15% of that need. So it's not realistic to expect the 80% that has been sort of the ballpark figure the administration is talking about actually can't meet the kinds of needs we have, for example, levees and dams, which are not appropriate, or replacement of existing highways. Again, you can't really do P3s to meet those needs. So we're hoping to see a detailed proposal from the president. It is important that it be large and robust, serious investment. From Congress, I can tell you what we're seeing on the committee, as best we can tell. Republican committee chairman Bill Schuster, who I work with closely on lots of issues, was quoted last month as saying he expects to have, quote, the mother of all bills for this summer to try to sweep in all different sectors, you know, rail, highway, airports, water systems. It gives us good reason to believe that the White House and Congress recognize that there is a really big series of problems the country needs to address, and the American people expect us to step up. The stumbling block is going to be, in part, how we fund it, and that's really where there are significant differences of opinion. We're dealing with some considerable challenges. Congress has not touched the gas tax since 1993, and the trust fund has failed to keep pace remotely with the growing needs for replacement and upgrading of our system. So that's a challenging issue, and I know I was on a panel yesterday with folks at Bloomberg with Senator Hoeven over on the Senate side, and he was asked directly on the gas tax, and he said, that's a non-starter. So that's a problem the Chamber of Commerce, and I'm sure many of you on this call have in the past spoken out in favor of the need to have the gas tax be able to keep pace with the needs. We're going to need your voices again, because this is going to be a heavy lift, particularly in the House, where many of my colleagues have signed Grover Norquist's No New Taxes pledge and are very concerned that they don't think that there will be support for them if they were to vote to even index the gas tax. There's broad bipartisan support to do something. We have, for example, the Highway Subcommittee Chairman Sam Graves and Ranking Member Eleanor Holmes Norton have led a letter to Chairman Brady. Kevin Brady is the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and there are 150 Democratic and Republican co-signers of this letter asking the committee to address the Highway Trust Fund shortfall. Right now it's getting backfilled out of revenues, general revenues, but it is on an unsustainable trajectory. There's an idea that has a lot of traction right now, and that's using revenue from a one-time repatriation of overseas profits of American companies. There is a lot of interest in that, but I can let you know that Speaker Paul Ryan, who I get to check in regularly because I work out with him in the gym, he has said that he needs funding from the health care bill to free up $880 billion to do tax reform, which is to say tax reduction. There are a lot of folks who are looking at repatriated profits to use for other programs, and that can be for programs themselves, for further tax reduction, or for deficit reduction. So you have lots of people who have eyes on the potential taxes you would get from repatriation, and the potential corpus of funds that you would get from that. So that money, I'm sad to say, that money has been counted probably four or five times over by different committees and different members of Congress who have designs on all the great things we can do if we get those several trillion dollars worth of overseas profits back into the U.S. economy. All of this has been complicated somewhat by a White House that has, frankly, had the worst news week ever, and that seems to continue every week. And that's obviously made it harder to get attention to bread and butter issues like what we're dealing with right now. So the president, I believe the president, would love to be talking jobs, especially this week. I suspect he very much is wondering why he didn't start with transportation and infrastructure, and instead has gotten himself wrapped around an axle on health care, which is slowed down, if not halted, in the Senate, and with tax reform, which is certainly going to not be any easier than health care reform is right now. A couple of other proposals that you should be aware of. There's a Penny for Progress proposal that has been put forward by Peter DeFazio, who's the top Democrat and longtime member of the Transportation Committee. It would raise the gas tax one penny per year for 30 years and then would issue bonds between now and 2030 to pay for infrastructure. It would also, there are other proposals. Earl Blumenauer has introduced a bill, reintroduced a bill that would raise and index the gas tax. Actually, President Trump has made favorable remarks about at least considering the gas tax, but then that was walked back by the White House right away. There are a couple of different proposals on the table to create infrastructure banks. One, a longtime proposal that my colleague from Connecticut, Rosa DeLauro, has put out there. Another more recent version of that by Congressman Delaney, who some of you may have had on Center Forward calls previously. And Congressman Delaney has a bipartisan bill that would call for using those repatriated overseas profits as the basis for creating an infrastructure bank. I think that will certainly hold some appeal to the president because it has a set aside for a certain percentage of those projects to be public-private partnerships. And finally, there over on the Senate side, there's the Move America Act. That's with a bipartisan effort led by Ron Wyden out of Oregon, a Democrat, and Hovind from North Dakota, Republican. They've introduced a bill that would expand tax-exempt private activity bonds and create a new infrastructure tax credit. That would give states significant flexibility for them to pursue infrastructure projects. I think there's broad agreement on both Democratic and Republican sides that ultimately it will be up to states to prioritize most of those projects. We all know we need to do this. We all know this is a core function of government, but the politics are complicating the timing, and things like no new taxes pledges are making it hard to do this sort of robust public investment that in the past was not only not a partisan issue, but it was part of the baseline that we considered as a country. Bob and I, and I can tell you, and I think most of my colleagues would agree with this, we cannot in America build a 21st century economy on a mid-20th century infrastructure. We absolutely have to do this, and when we do, the last point I'm going to raise, not out of my committee, it's not out of transportation and infrastructure, but I think needs to be part of the package, is what I've termed infrastructure, and that is recognizing the reality that the growing parts of our economy in America now are based on information and technology. And for that, we need an energy system that is resilient, redundant, reliable, sustainable, and cyber secure. And we also need to have information technology available to all Americans. So we need internet everywhere. So though that infrastructure component, I think, needs to be viewed as part of the basic public works that government helps provide for all Americans. If we want everyone to be able to compete and participate in our economy, we need to ensure that those pieces are incorporated as well. So that's sort of the state of play or where we are. The last thing I'll say is your voices are unbelievably important. You cannot imagine how essential it is that you lean in and call and meet with your members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, and the White House, to let them know your support for America governing at the national level. Not all of these projects can be done by states alone. Traditionally, they have only been done with the federal government paying the lion's share. And when our state and local governments are strained right now, it is even more important that Congress do its job, working with the White House to ensure that these basic public works, these basic services, infrastructure, infrastructure and transportation are safe, efficient, and the envy of the world rather than the embarrassment of arriving at LaGuardia Airport, where I arrived recently to be greeted by a blue tarp duct taped to the ceiling to funnel water that was leaking through the roof down into a 30-gallon trash can. So that is not the America we want to be proud of. We can and need to do better, and I'm looking forward to your questions and want to thank again Senator Forward and Elizabeth for convening all of you, and hope that gives you a little bit of information for us to have a further conversation.
Great. Well, thank you. Just a reminder, anybody who would like to ask a question, press 1 on your telephone keypad, or you can email that question to us at info@businessfwd.org. We do have a couple emailed questions that I'll get to in a minute, but we're going to start with Kathy Shandling. Kathy, your line's open. Go ahead and introduce yourself with where you're calling from in your business, and ask your question.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Shandling. I'm the executive director of something called the International Private Water Association, which is all about the development of public-private partnerships both in the United States and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed by your presentation, but I do have a question on the water. At what point is Congress, both Democrats, Republicans, both the House and the Senate, going to start really focusing on water and infrastructure and realize how water and energy go hand in hand? Water and transportation also go hand in hand. At what point is there going to be some interest in making sure that there's somebody running the Office of Water, which right now is vacant, and that water infrastructure is as important as transportation?
Absolutely. Well, Kathy, thank you for your work, and you are absolutely right. Water is essential. A shockingly large amount of our water consumption in the country is devoted to energy production and vice versa. So you couldn't be more right about the intimate connection between water and energy in this country. You are right about needing that position needing to be filled. Sadly, we are at a point of historically low numbers of administration positions filled. I won't get into all the reasons why that's the case. A lot of it is there just haven't been many nominations been put forward. And people were not vetted in advance to be ready to go. And it does hamper our ability to move forward on really important projects. I was actually in India a couple of months ago with a bipartisan congressional delegation where we saw some of the really innovative projects that organizations like yours are being involved in around the world, where they're finding very different ways to, for example, use solar power, have independent freestanding water systems, which they're going to need to have in places like India. So we need to be innovative, but much of America's water infrastructure is incredibly aging. And just to use an example of where this comes to the fore, you take New York City, where you've got, with rising tides and climate change, you've got storm surges that are getting into wastewater tunnels as well as into the subway tunnels. You are pumping water. You are dealing with infiltration of seawater into fresh water. And all of this comes together in the tunnels under New York City. And if we don't maintain and upgrade what we have, we will lose it with devastating results, as we saw in Flint, Michigan. It's incredibly important. That's one of the reasons why I'm on the Water Resources Subcommittee, because we look at these issues. Absolutely. Great point, Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is an emailed question from Susan Oler in Kentucky. And she said, you mentioned infrastructure. I live in a rural area where the internet is slow at best. When our country developed phone lines, there was a commitment to, quote, the last mile.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't there a similar commitment to high-speed internet access, and how can we increase internet access in rural areas?
Well, Susan, I feel your pain because although I represent Connecticut, the northwest corner of Connecticut, which I have the honor of representing, has exactly these same issues. We're struggling in Connecticut. We don't get cell phone coverage in significant areas of my district because they are not very populated. It's rural area or forested. And I would fully agree with you. It is far easier to get people to give up their landlines right now than it is to ask people to give up either cell phones or internet access. And I do think we need to rethink for America what are the most essential services that government needs to ensure that every American has access to. And I completely agree that's got to include access to the information economy. So that does mean we've got to find some way to finance it. And actually, this very much is an area where P3s can play a role. And so I'm working on a Green Bank bill with some folks, and that structure can be used to help finance energy as well as internet. And I think we need to get the FCC on board with working with us on this, but it is going to be incredibly important if we want to make sure that rural America is not left behind. We made a huge investment with the TVA to ensure that people in rural America were not left behind when electricity was transforming things around this country. The same kind of commitment, I think, needs to happen for the entire country to ensure that all Americans, whether they live in a poor inner city or in a rural area in Kentucky or northwest Connecticut or in the wealthiest suburb in the land, everyone needs to have access to this because that's how you get the good jobs. That's how you remain connected to your family.
Thanks. Our next question is a live question, and this comes from Ronald Sherga. Ronald, go ahead and let us know where you're calling from and ask your question.
Sure. I'm calling from Arlington, Texas, and I have a company, EcoStraight. I transform waste into various value-added products. And, one of the encounters we have, Senator, is, really the slowness of innovation within the infrastructure. I mean, right now to get any new product approved within any DOT is a 5 to 6 year process, and no small entrepreneur can navigate that. I mean, it's just stifling us, and I just wanted to know if you yourself see any way to streamline innovation, because there's products and solutions out there, but I hate to say it, but they get caught up in cronyism and unfortunately large enterprises that stifle these barriers. Are there plans to adopt some of these things and streamline these processes to save taxpayers money and get these products into the marketplace?
Well, thank you, Ronald, and you could not be more right. I say this with all due affection because my father and grandfather were civil engineers, frankly, there's actually a lot of military folks who tend to be in this area and tend to be kind of conservative by nature. So I think that's one of the challenges. There's a lot of bipartisan awareness, and I'm one of those people at the table with my Republican colleagues on precisely this concern. It is on the stifling of innovation that tends to happen when the current players get to write the rules. And so we need to move to a different way of doing our regulation in a lot of these areas if we're going to continue to incentivize and support the kind of innovation that your company is engaged in. And I'm very aware that that's a big issue. There's a second problem, and you may have encountered this already. Not only are the standards written in a way that tend to be process standards rather than meeting a particular performance standard. So I've been part of a group looking to see areas where we can look for performance standards that can be rolling and incorporate innovation rather than process that holds us back. There's a second piece that also often gets involved, and that is, that has to do with how the procurement operates. There's oftentimes, particularly on the military side, but often on big U.S. DOT projects, there can be a strong preference either in regulation or just in practice for larger companies that makes it harder to get accepted as a bidder if, for example, you have, and I'll use the kinds of things we've worked on in Connecticut, where we've been trying to get better drainage with different products for topping our roads. So then you have less runoff, you have less environmental degradation, and in fact you're restoring the aquifer better. Well, it's really hard to get those first projects through because no one can tell you how long will this product last. Is it going to last 50 years? Is it going to last 20 years? So we do need to work on that. And America's greatest strength is our innovation. And we need to bring that into play in USDOT. And I'd love to find a way. If you could reach out to my office, Ronald, I'd love to connect with you and get your thoughts on any specific suggestions you have, because you are absolutely right. We have got to innovate, and we've got to streamline processes. It's very important.
Great. We can help make that connection after this call. Our next question comes from Manish Kathari. Manish, your line is open. Go ahead and introduce yourself and ask your question.
Thank you. Congressman, thank you very much for your remarks.
I'm President and CEO of Shiladi Associates, an architectural consulting firm that works in U.S. and overseas. And I'm also chair-elect of American Council of Engineering Companies. I'm very pleased to hear you come from a family of engineers, so you not only understand but appreciate that lack of investment in infrastructure has impacts that go for decades. So we are already late. It's not the question of what we should be doing, but I think how quickly we should be addressing it.
Absolutely.
The question I have is that, infrastructure has always had a bipartisan support over the years, though as time has gone by, the Highway Trust Fund has been raided time and again. I think about $180 billion has been taken out of it, and there's a shortfall of other things. So what could we do, to other than writing to our congressmen and senators and to the White House, to ensure that a national infrastructure plan, which combines incentives to promote private investment, such as tax-preferred financing or core federal programs that support road bridges, as well as the critical infrastructure throughout the country, but also to promote the U.S. engineering firms on P3 projects, because, we talk about job creations, we talk about economic growth, but a lot of P3 projects that are won by the Spanish and now the Chinese are setting up companies to make investment. So if you're not careful, you run the risk of not benefiting the American firms. And the last question I had was about the reforms required on the regulatory or the permitting side for infrastructure plan. United States has some of the most, takes longest time. It takes, I think, 9 years or 10 years to get a major infrastructure project just through a permit process.
Absolutely. Well, Manish, thank you for your efforts, and you are right on all of those counts. I may take them in reverse order on the streamlining. Shortly after I became vice-ranking member of the committee, I actually brought the Congressional Research Service in to do a very long briefing with me of like every report that's been done on where are there opportunities for us to streamline permitting and, for example, to more aggressively say whoever has the highest standard, whether it's the locality or the state level or the federal level, we should be doing that, and we should be operating on parallel tracks to simultaneously try to permit. I use the example of the Army Corps of Engineers, who were in my office yesterday. Some of their reports, sort of feasibility reports, can take a decade up to 17 years long. That is insane. In the intervening time, you have costs double, triple, quadruple, and you have, to go back to Ronald's point, you've locked in either a design or particular processes that don't even make sense anymore. So it is imperative that we figure out how to get this done faster. But we do have a challenge with federalism, and I think we just need to put it on the table. Unlike most other countries, we have a robust federal system in which localities, not only localities, but individual landowners have enormous legal rights in our land rights in our country, and that does make it a little harder for us to do. Most other countries have much greater ability for the federal government to just mandate. They don't have a takings clause. They don't have to worry about that to the same extent we do. So we do have a legal structure that's always going to make that somewhat more complicated in the U.S. But again, I think when members of Congress and taxpayers and environmentalists and construction companies and our commuters on our roads, for example, all understand that a project that takes 10 years to permit means you're only going to have your tax dollars go about half as far. So we've got to find a better way to do it. I just see it as a direct trade-off of, you know, time and money. So we have to figure out how to do that better. I'm not sure, and I'd love to get further thoughts from you on what we can do to incentivize U.S. firms taking a leadership in doing the engineering work. Don't have a good answer to that, but it is an important point that you raise. And it did used to be bipartisan, and it needs to return to that. I spent a lot of time on the committee on bipartisan efforts, and I can tell you, you know, I've had good success. We did a bipartisan long-term highway bill a year and a half ago. I've got a brownfields bill that I've been working on for the last year and a half that I have a Republican co-sponsor, the Republican chairman of the subcommittee, who is a different Graves. We have two Graves who are subcommittee chairmen, but Garrett Graves from Louisiana took an hour with me week before last to go over that bill, and we're trying to get it through committee. So I find that there's a lot of will on the individual level. The issue tends to get hung up higher up at sort of party leadership levels that have been the greater stumbling block than actually the will of individual members, I would say.
Thank you. We've got time for a couple more questions. Our next question is from Paolo Avila. Paolo, your line is open.
Great. Thank you so much. My name again is Paola Avila. I'm Vice President at the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce. Uh-huh. And being here on the border in San Diego, infrastructure surrounding our land and seaports are tremendously important to our economy, but it's certainly of a national interest as well, as it facilitates the movement of goods on a national level, supporting trade and our export market. And yet many of the decisions that are made in D.C. and Washington are by those who are far from the border, so sometimes it gets lost as a local or regional infrastructure need. So I just wanted to highlight that. It certainly not only serves our economy, but also has an environmental impact as congestion around our ports with truck traffic around the commercial ports certainly have a negative impact on our air quality. So I wanted to mention that as infrastructure proposals do move forward, how important that is to keep in mind and the impact on a national level. You had mentioned that the states will be the ones often taking the responsibility of prioritizing those infrastructure projects. But again, just to advocate for the national interest of moving trade at our land and seaports. Thank you.
Absolutely. And Paola, that's a great point, and I'm glad you mentioned seaports. And I will be sure to say hi to Scott Peters, your congressman who sat next to me this morning in Veterans. The seaports are really important, and in San Diego, seeing what happens when Congress doesn't do the right thing. There are user fees that fund the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. Half of that fund has been raided and applied to the general fund. As a result, we are not keeping up with the dredging and expansion of our ports. And as you know full well in San Diego, what has happened is the Chinese, now that they were seeing, as the world was seeing, that the expanded Panama Canal, the post-Panamax ships, were going to be coming on board a year ahead of schedule. And so China has built 5 ports off the western coast of Mexico, and that traffic is now coming up by truck across the border into California. Now, mostly into California. So that's a border issue. That's a national security and border issue. It's lost revenue because you've got China is shipping, doing the shipping, as well as imposing the cost for us at the border and security concerns at the border. And it also means lost revenue for Long Beach, rather, and San Diego and all up and down the West Coast. And that is in part a failure of the U.S. government and of Congress to ensure that Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, funded by the people who do the shipping, is used for its intended purpose. And that means to dredge those ports and keep them open, including for the new post-Panamax boats. So you are right, it needs to be a national priority. we need to focus on. This is a different kind of last mile. We had Susan earlier talk about the last mile for internet. We also need the last mile to go from the port, to get from the port to rail, or from the port to highways in ways that make sense for growing, burgeoning economic hubs like San Diego. So we've got a lot of work to do, but you know, those are very good points that you raised, Paola. Thank you.
So we're going to go to one quick email question here and then maybe one more live question. We'll try to get through these quickly. This is from Terrence Hart, who's writing from Allison Park, Pennsylvania. And he is asking, does the Congressman believe that any pending infrastructure appropriation would ultimately include any funding for R&D activities that would enable development and implementation of new advanced infrastructure-related technologies?
Well, Terrence, I hope so. I'm certainly pushing for some of those provisions. One of my other committee assignments is on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, on the Research and Technology Subcommittee. So I try to push from both of those positions, both on transportation and infrastructure and on the Science Committee, to ensure, and again, this loops back to the earlier question, to Ronald's earlier question about innovation. I think there is absolutely an important role for federal tax dollars to be thinking actively and funding in part for the sort of cutting-edge technology that we're going to need to not just replace our mid-20th century infrastructure, because we shouldn't be just redoing what we did in 1950 and 1960. We need to be doing better and smarter and more resilient and more eco-friendly, and we should be taking advantage of those talents and that design capability and new materials in ways that things are lighter and cheaper and last longer. So I think there's enormous opportunity there. And again, would love, Terrence, if you have particular knowledge and expertise, I am thrilled to be able to get good help from people who are in the field around the country who have ideas of what we can do.
Thanks. One more quick question here before we close things out. Tess Winningham, your line's open. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thank you, Congresswoman and everyone. I hope you can hear me okay.
It's a little fuzzy. If you're able to pick up your phone, that'd be great, or maybe just speak a little quieter.
Okay, sorry about that. My name is Tess Winningham. I'm with Alignment Simple Solutions, and we patented and invented a portable alignment system that is used by military and government around the world, specifically the U.S. government. But we have been trying, one of our biggest challenges is to get out in front of the infrastructure build and in front of all of the opportunities that are there by hopefully getting on the GSA. And our challenge has been that it is so time-consuming and difficult. I'm wondering if you have any advice on how, as a small business, we can take a new invention that could save millions of dollars and get it in front of the right people, especially before the infrastructure starts in trucks and fleets and things like that. Thank you.
Well, I will do my best. I was not catching every word there, but what I did glean was, you know, what do we do again for small innovative companies like yours to get in front of the people who would be making decisions about both what are design and other specs that might be contemplated, as well as actually just even to be selected in. When it's time for actual contracting, letting out contracts. I don't know right off the bat, but I have a couple of thoughts, and I need to check. And in fact, I'll be heading in just a little bit over to meet with some of the many hundreds of people who have come in to Washington for National Infrastructure Week. If there is not already, there ought to be sort of an innovation summit. And I may see if I can help organize that with some of my colleagues on the committee and maybe on the science committee too, to have an innovation summit around transportation and infrastructure to try to bring folks to Washington and convene to meet with the relevant folks in the Department of Transportation to talk about and have them hear from you some of your experiences and to begin to brainstorm on what we can do. I know I did something like this in the prior administration. I did for the Department of Commerce. I brought in I brought in folks who were having issues around importing and took them to the White House, and we sat down with the Vice President and we sat down with the Secretary of Commerce to just so that people could hear stories of some of the challenges that are being faced. I'd love to try to figure out how we could do something like that. We certainly ought to be able to bring people to to convene some listening sessions and some planning to really understand the nature of the challenges you're having, and then try to share them with the Department of Transportation so that we can together, that Congress and the Department of Transportation can together figure that. We probably also, frankly, need to loop in the secretaries and commissioners of transportation around the country at the state level, because whatever we do at the national level, if the states aren't on board, you may find yourself out of luck. So, again, important points that you're raising, and certainly hearing a strong theme about the innovative spirit alive and well in America, that makes me optimistic. But we've got a big task to upgrade and update even the mindset of a lot of folks who work in this field to realize not only is this not a threat, but it's an imperative to be embracing innovation.
Thanks. Just to close things out, you mentioned that the President might have wished he started with infrastructure. Why didn't the new administration or the new Congress start with that? It seems like it could have been a big bipartisan win. Are there political or legislative considerations that might not be obvious to us kind of watching this debate from around the country?
Sure. Yes, there are. there are some timelines in Congress as well as some pre-existing commitments that explain why transportation why a big infrastructure and transportation bill hasn't happened yet. Essentially, the priority has been for I can speak with more authority on the House side since I know the dynamics here better. The top priority for Speaker Paul Ryan has been to do tax reform. That's been a priority for him for a number of years, tax and entitlement reform. In order to do that, he needs actually to free up significant spending cuts to do that. He is doing that, and that is why we see the health care bill going through the House twice, an attempt first that failed, a second attempt that passed, but it's now somewhat stalled in the Senate. Speaker Ryan needed to do that first, both to honor a political commitment to repeal and replace, but more concretely to free up $880 billion, which are then already being worked into the House Republican Ways and Means Bill for overhaul of corporate tax and corporate and personal tax to reduce the number of tax brackets, to simplify, to substantially change corporate tax rates, border adjustment tax, and other things, which would lose revenue very significantly, so they actually needed to free money up by counting some of those taxes that had been included on the highest income earners as part of the Affordable Care Act. So that explains that sequencing. Also, to pass through the Senate, this is kind of down in the weeds of the bills, the only way something passes the Senate on less than a 60-vote margin right now, it has to be under budget reconciliation. We are currently in an extended budget, continuing resolution on a budget. That expires the end of September when we will be in a new budget year. So the clock is ticking to do any of these things. It has to be done by the end. The Affordable Care Act vote replacement has to happen or not by the end of September. So that's got to come first to free up money with which you can try to do tax reform. And only once those two things are done, then you know what the configuration, in particular for repatriation, what that looks like to then decide how you can do infrastructure. I think personally, from what I understand from folks second and third hand from the White House, I think the President would have rather started with infrastructure and tax because he knows that it's popular with the public. But for reasons within the dynamics of Congress, that was not going to happen, at least certainly not in the House. And obviously, McConnell has not supported that approach either in the Senate.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you, Congresswoman Elizabeth Estey, for joining us today, and for all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join the conversation. Please check your email for a recording of today's call and a quick survey. We're always trying to improve the quality of our programming and really appreciate your feedback. So again, thank you to Representative Estey and all of you, and please watch your email for a recording of the call and that survey. Talk to you soon. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks very much.